Welcome back to the London Lyceum podcast. For those of our regular listeners, you know that the London Lyceum seeks to foster serious thinking for a serious church in a way that embodies the values of charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. I'm Hunter Heinzman, and I'm also joined by Leland Brown. We're excited to today to be interviewing Jordan Baller. For those who know Jordan, he's a friend of the London Lyceum. He was a contributor to our journal, the Hanover Review's famous or infamous symposium on Matthew Barrett's Reformation as Renewal. He's the executive director at the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy. And there he really just lives out his passion for combining a robust theological understanding of social life with a comprehensive and interdisciplinary approach to the development of civil society. So very interesting work. A lot of these kind of public theology, political theology, and really putting some of those things into practice there. He's also the general editor for the 12-volume Abraham Kuyper Collected Works in Public Theology series. And he, along with Eric Mattson, his co-author and editor, have two upcoming publications in May, I think, with Baker Academic. And they are going to be a history of Christian political economy, and as well as a sources, a kind of an anthology of primary sources from the early church to the 20th century in Christian political economy. So I'm excited to talk with him today. We're not going to talk with him about those books. We're going to have a second interview with him closer to release date on those books. But today we're actually going to be talking with him about his work at the Center, what the Center does, and just political theology in general. Because I think if there's any field that resists the values of charity, a faithful curiosity that's open to reason, wherever it's found, critical thinking and cheerfulness, it's politics. So, Jordan, would you just mind telling us a little bit of your personal story and how you came to be invested into research and work in the field of political and public theology?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. I will note those two volumes are from B&H Academic.
Oh, B&H. My bad.
A little closer to home for you. Not for me. I'm actually in my basement in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So Baker's, you know, just on the other side of town for me. But yeah, just to clarify that. So how did I end up doing what I'm doing now? Well, Providence, for one thing. It's the sort of thing that you couldn't plan. Grew up Church of Christ. In California, Virginia. I won't take you through my whole biography, just give you a quick thumbnail sketch. And at an early age, felt called to do something with theology or the ministry. I was at a youth retreat at Milligan College in Tennessee and felt called to pursue that as a vocation. Moved to Detroit on the east side of Michigan. Started going to church with friends. I was at a Lutheran high school. Became Lutheran. Didn't know much about church history, really, or was not really sophisticated theologically at all. Went to my undergrad at Michigan State, was planning again on pursuing theology after undergrad. But I really didn't know what that meant. I didn't know anything about the theological landscape or anything like that. I was just responding to this felt kind of call to pursue. And I didn't know whether it was going to be, you know, pastoral ministry or some other form, missions, something like that. So, got a little more sophisticated, I guess, in the sense of, you know, knowing where I was at. For various reasons, ended up at Calvin Theological Seminary here in Grand Rapids, while still Missouri Synod Lutheran. A Lutheran who knew who Luther and Melanchthon were, but really didn't know who John Calvin was, like most Lutherans. You know, the reciprocation between those two traditions is not one-to-one, typically. So, yeah, came to Calvin Theological Seminary, didn't know anything about, well, West Michigan, the Dutch tradition, the Dutch Reformed tradition, Presbyterianism more broadly. Again, got a little more sophisticated as one does, you know, at a place like Calvin Theological Seminary, started reading confessions, learning more about church history, including who Calvin was, who Herman Bavinck was, who Abraham Kuyper was. And I realized convictionally I'm Reformed. So joined a Reformed denomination here and have been at home there ever since. So that's a little bit how I got to where I'm at ecclesiastically. In terms of the vocation, I never felt really called to pursue the pastoral side of things. So the first degree I did at Calvin was an MTS, you know, the academic kind of half of an MDiv. And while I was in that program, I was actually thinking about doing work in archaeology or ancient Near Eastern studies. Had done some archaeological work in Israel at a dig in Bethsaida while I was an undergrad. Had a fantastic professor at Calvin Theological Seminary named named Bastian van Elderen, who was involved in a number of things and had connections to the Dead Sea Scrolls project and other things. And I went to a seminar, and this is going to come full circle later because we're going to talk about what we're doing at the CRCD. I went to a seminar for people in grad school, and I think this one might have even been focused on seminarians or people who were pursuing a religious vocation or in religious studies grad school of some kind. From the Acton Institute. So the Acton Institute's a think tank that's based here in Grand Rapids. And I had been reading some things, like at the time I was reading Avery Dulles' Models of the Church. So I was thinking about ecclesiology and some other things, but I got exposed through lectures and readings there to what you would think of now as political theology. That term wasn't as much in vogue then as it is now. But yeah, really the intersection between the Christian faith and social life and social responsibility and discipleship in a robust sense in the world. And that opened my eyes to a whole world of things that I never really considered before in terms of the relevance of the faith to modern life and things like that. So the Acton Institute happened to be hiring at the time for a paid internship, and I was working a temporary job on the receiving dock at Bissell, who's a vacuum manufacturer here in Grand Rapids. Not a close alignment to my future goals in terms of academic work. So got a job working at Acton, writing and doing various things, first in communications and public policy, and then later on the academic side. And so that's really how I kind of got into the think tank world, which is an interesting institutional environment to do political theology work. We could talk more about that. There are not too many think tanks that hire theologians, but that's where I ended up and how I got now 20 plus years later in a career in if you want to call it public theology or political theology.
I guess that just before we get to your specific center, why don't you tell our audience, because I know I'm not super familiar with, Stephen Presley, a great friend of the London Lyceum, is one of my doctoral supervisor, works at the same think tank, and he often refers to it as a think tank. And I'm often thinking, I don't really know what a think tank is, but I trust that you're doing good work there. So would you mind just telling us a little bit about a think tank, and then we'll look more specifically at y'all's specific think tank?
Yeah, so that's one of the great things about working at a think tank is nobody really knows what they are or what they do. Even the people who work at think tanks don't always know what's happening. It's mysterious and important work, I can tell you that. There's a lot of ways we could go with this. You know, historically, think tanks arose in the mid-20th century, almost like alternative faculties. Often for conservatives, but not strictly for conservatives, but places for academics to land. Sometimes that would be as a way station between the academy and serving in government. Sometimes it would be ideological. So, the academy, maybe traditionally, broadly speaking, has not been as friendly to conservatives as to, you know, some other types of scholars. And so many think tanks arose as kinds of places where conservative-minded faculty or academics or scholars could land. Often they have a policy focus, but not exclusively. So it's a very diverse kind of landscape. So that's the big history of what you could call think tanks, or which is often shorthand for something like educational and research institutions. Again, covering many disciplines, often political economy or politics or economics, international theory, public policy, these kinds of things. But one of the great things about America is we've got this really robust tradition, history, and landscape of civil society, which includes think tanks, but of course isn't limited to them. At one point, there was a program at the University of Pennsylvania, the Think Tanks and Civil Society program, which was kind of tracking the numbers and types of think tanks across the world. And by far, the vast majority of them existed in North America, and within North America, most of those inside the United States. It's a function of wealth, certainly, to be able to have these kinds of institutions. The richer society you are, the more kind of diverse the landscape can be. But it's also the kind of unique American character of associationism and thinking as kind of social and creative entrepreneurs in that way that think tanks came about. It became a kind of feature of the social and political landscape of the 20th and now the 21st century.
And what would you say is sort of the particular value of a think tank? Is it the independence it gives for thinkers? Is it sort of a focused mission that's not necessarily education like a seminary or academic institution would be. What would you say is sort of the niche that it fits in and how it helps?
Yeah, broadly speaking, I would say it fills a gap in a richer landscape, I would say, of intellectual life, you could say. It depends on the particular mission of the think tank and so on. And there's a, as I kind of indicated earlier, a spectrum of ones that are much more kind of practically oriented and ones that are much more ideas oriented. Excuse me. Some that are much more programmatic in terms of running programs, others that are much more focused on publications and things like that, or all of the above, depending on the size and scope and robustness of the particular institution. I think it adds a kind of richness to the landscape in the sense that, you know, you don't have people necessarily working for other kinds of direct institutional interests as they might if they were a government employee or an employee of another kind of bureaucracy, like a higher educational institution or something like that. Now, even among think tanks, there are different types, right? So there are ones that are independent, standalone, maybe they're just the think tank, whatever it is, like the American Enterprise Institute or the Brookings Institution, as far as I know, things like that. There are other ones that are, you could call think tanks, that are more or less affiliated with government organizations or with universities and colleges. So they may be embedded in a larger institutional environment. And then there are unique ones like the one that I work at now, which is actually the only one that I know of that is at a law firm. So we can talk about that in a few minutes when we talk about the origins of this center that I now direct and its unique kind of role. But I mean, it's a bit like trying to categorize business, right? Like, what does business do? Well, I mean, in a way, there's no business. There's no such thing as business. There's only businesses, right? There's no such thing as, you know, the think tank. There's just many, many different think tanks that all have their own unique kind of mission and vision and niche and challenge that they're aimed at addressing. Some of them are larger, some of them more narrow.
Well, I think this is a good time to really dive into y'all's in particular. So the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy, or the CRCD, is that correct? It says, y'all's vision statement says, the CRCD envisions democratic societies which affirm the essential role of religious convictions, peoples, and institutions in cultivating free communities where all people can flourish. So would you mind just kind of talking a little bit about that and its connection with the law firm and how that comes about? And we can get into, from here, we can get into a lot of different things. I know y'all's mission, natural law, I know is a big thing just in what y'all engage in. And so just love to just see where this conversation goes as we talk about the CRCD.
Sure, that sounds good. You did a good job with that vision statement. It sounds like something a bunch of academics may have sat around a room and put together. Because that's in fact what happened. We had a bunch of people, you know, about five or six of us who were fellows of the CRCD at the time, you know, sat around a room and developed that mission and vision statement that we still have to this day. So the origins of the CRCD, First Liberty Institute is the nation's largest law firm, public interest law firm that focuses exclusively on religious liberty litigation. It's been around in one form or another under the leadership of Kelly Shackelford Kelly's been doing this work for about 30 years. And First Liberty is in the same kind of environment in public interest litigation and legal work as Alliance Defending Freedom and the Beckett Fund and some others. There's some distinctives about the different firms in terms of their focus or their approach and the kinds of cases they take and that kind of thing. But First Liberty is in that ecosystem of public interest litigation, focused specifically on religious liberty. And about 5 years ago, in the middle of a pandemic, the leadership at First Liberty had this idea, why don't we start a think tank? I think from the beginning, maybe because they had the name Institute, they thought, you know, some of what we're going to do, we'll have a think tank kind of a dimension to it. Some of the things we had already been talking about in terms of student programming and doing research and things like that. And in fact, First Liberty had already been doing some student programming. And they wanted to formalize that and expand it in a way. And the result was the formation of a think tank, a center, essentially a department at First Liberty. So there's lots of things you could say about that. I mean, fascinating to me and really humbling that a group of litigators and attorneys would think, you know, what we're doing is really important. And obviously you have to be mission focused to work in certainly the nonprofit sector in general, but the faith-based nonprofit sector and the kinds of work that First Liberty is doing. I mean, some of these cases take years and years and years and blood, sweat, and tears and prayer to see them through. And at the end, you know, you may not be victorious. So lots of faithfulness and perseverance there. And then to see that in the light that, yes, what we're doing, we see this as of immense importance for our clients, and we want to win these cases and set these good precedents, but what we're doing isn't enough, or what we're doing has to be complemented by other things. And so one way of thinking about the way that the center's work relates to the broader work of First Liberty is that First Liberty is creating the legal space for people to live out their faith. And the center, through its various work channels of work and programs and things like that, is encouraging and equipping people to do that in all kinds of spheres. So we definitely do focus on people who are discerning going to law school and becoming lawyers. You know, we have programs that are focused on people that are thinking about that kind of work and going into public service, but also more broadly in all kinds of other fields too. So that's one way of thinking about how the center relates to the broader work of First Liberty is not just thinking about our religious rights and protecting those, but how do we live out responsibly as people of faith in society and exploring that from a kind of academic perspective. So we'll talk about trends in secularism and from religious liberty, from religious perspectives and religious history perspectives, the kinds of trends and sociological trends you get, but then also very practically, you know, introducing students to sources and ideas that they otherwise wouldn't get exposure to that will help them become better citizens and better followers of Jesus.
That's super helpful. Sounds like really engaging work. Would you guys would the center put itself in any camp for political theology or perspective? Like if you think of Niebuhr's old categories, Christ against culture or transforming culture. Sure. Is there a philosophy that's shared or a model that they'll generally agree on as a center?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the reasons we hired Stephen Presley was to help us articulate and develop that work. And so I don't want to speak for him. He's got plenty of works that speak for themselves, and you've had him on here and you probably will again, and he can speak for himself. But I would say broadly, yeah, if you have a kind of typology like that in mind, it's something like a cultural engagement model. You know, Stephen has the term cultural sanctification. I think it's not that we have that in our constitutive documents at the CRCD, but that's certainly the kind of work and the kind of perspective that we try to embody. Conservative, certainly, you know, in a small C traditionalist sense, right? Like we see that there are permanent things in the world that God has given us that need to be protected and preserved, but also open to the kinds of dynamism and creativity that he created us in his image to be. So definitely not retreatist, you know, that culture is some bad thing that we have to avoid. Not a triumphalist in the sense that culture is something that we have to come out and dominate and that Christians have to be the ones controlling everything in a society for it to flourish. But much more like Christians have a unique role and calling to serve the public good. And that's a big part of what we want to do at the CRCD is make the case for the public good of religion and religious liberty and people of faith in the public square, but then also not just say, well, this is true, kind of descriptively, but also encourage people to be those kinds of citizens who are living out their faith and sacrificing for their neighbors and being good neighbors and loving their neighbors.
Yeah, I think this is a really just an important topic. And I really want to kind of dive in on just what you kind of keyed in on is religion as a public good, which is also part of y'all's mission statement on y'all's website. Would you mind just kind of clarifying for us what you mean by that? Like, what does it mean for something to be a public good? And then, like, when we're talking about religion, are we talking about Christianity? Are we talking about a generic Judeo-Christian civic religion or just any religion whatsoever? So help us kind of understand the phrase religion as a public good.
Yeah. So on the public good side, I would classify it just kind of broadly as something that contributes to the well-being and the flourishing of things beyond itself, right? So you could imagine something that manifests its own good, and that's all it does. It doesn't have any spillover effects or a halo effect or anything like that. But that's not what we conceive of as religion as a public good. Religion as a public good is something that goes beyond itself, and certainly seeks its own, you know, its own ends in an appropriate way, but does so in a way that is contributing to the flourishing of the society beyond itself. And there's a lot to unpack there. Religion, certainly religious liberty for all. I mean, that's what First Liberty is founded to protect, for all Americans, for all people. We do focus on broadly Christianity and the Judeo-Christian tradition, inclusive of practicing Jews, interested in questions about what religious faithfulness looks like in other traditions as well. So we've done conversations and had events and things like that engage with traditions, including Islam and other things. First Liberty is a Christian organization. You have to sign a statement of faith to work there, including the CRCD. So it's a Christian organization, but in the same way that I was talking about religion contributing as a public good beyond itself, it's not just aimed at Christians. It's aimed at the good of all people, for all Americans, including those who don't claim a religious faith. We think religious liberty is good, not just for people who practice religion, but for people who disclaim religion. It's actually good for them to have space for religious liberty too. So, yeah, we think of religion broadly in that sense, although the people who work at First Liberty and at the CRCD, and the kinds of questions we tend to pursue because of our vocational backgrounds, and our convictions, tend to be more focused on the Judeo-Christian traditions, more broadly speaking, if you want to put it that way. We also have a very strong historical bent. Stephen Pressley's a historian. My training is also in historical theology, intellectual history. So part of that is also parsing out what does it mean in America for religion to be a public good. And that goes into the background of our name, the Center for Religion, Culture, Democracy. We understand historically as well as normatively that religion, when understood as having this kind of focus on civil life, produces cultural institutions that then set up the context for people to practice democratic self-government. So there's this virtuous cycle, you could say, or this virtuous feedback loop between religion, the cultural institutions that make self-government possible. And we think this is descriptive of you know, the situation at the American founding, for example, as well as something that we ought to aspire to now, 250 years later, for example, looking back on the Declaration of Independence and the founding era as something we aspire to manifest now today as well.
So just to double click on sort of the religious liberty conversation, there's a lot of heat out there about the government's role in religion right now. We've got the Christian nationalism conversation, Stephen Wolford, a very controversial book. You've also got Miles Smith's book, sort of working through early America, describing a general Protestant culture that sort of undergirded all of early American democracy. So how would you articulate the government's role in it with religion? Is it preserving the freedom for practice religion? Is it promoting religion? What are the lines as you would see them?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think about this historically and what's unique about the American experiment. My own academic background is in the Reformation period, so I come at it from a perspective where you're looking at the diversity of approaches to church and state, for example, in the 16th and 17th centuries, and then how that maps on both in terms of what's continuous and then what's really new, certainly in a constitutional institutional structure like the First Amendment in the United States. So I tend to think of it more as, you know, the government from a theological perspective, and the ontology of it is God's minister, you know, in the language of Romans 13. That doesn't mean that people in the government even have to acknowledge that for it to be the case, right? So there's a distinction there between what people confess or what they recognize and what's actually the case. And so I think it's a long, it's a belief that has a long provenance in Christian tradition, that regardless of whether it's itself self-cognizant of the fact that it's God's servant, it is functionally God's servant, whether it's the, you know, the Roman Emperor or the Roman Republic or the consistory in Calvin's Geneva or the American federal government. They're God's ministers to do good. And part of the good that the government is called to do is to protect the rights and preserve the possibility for people to live out their faith in public life. Certainly, in the, I think explicitly that way in the American construction. So that's broadly speaking, right? And then there, you know, we tend to kind of, when we get into these conversations, I think slip into pretty misleading dichotomies, right? Like you either have establishment, an establishment system, like you could think of in classical European senses, or it's a secular state, right? And the reality is there's all shades of all kinds of things in between those two extremes, perhaps. And even there's different kinds of secularism depending on what you mean by the term. And the American institutional disestablishment is quite different than a French laïcité secularism or something like that. So I think of the government as from a version, certainly, maybe not the only version, but a version and perhaps even a kind of standard line of Reformed political theology, which I would identify with as God's servant to protect and promote civil order, which includes protecting the space for the church and for religious institutions to be authentic to themselves. So the government has an expansive role in one sense. It's the only sphere, to use Kuiper's terminology, that has this kind of overarching authority to order things and to promote political justice in that most comprehensive and robust way. But it also is strikingly limited in the sense that it has to respect and does not create, but simply acknowledges the authority, the legitimacy, the sovereignty of other spheres or other institutions, including foremost among which you could say is the church. Certainly it's been understood that way in the American setting where you've got religious liberty enshrined as the first freedom in the First Amendment. So there's a priority, I think, you could think of conceptually as well as theoretically and historically for why religious liberty is so important to the American experiment.
And so with this kind of understanding of religious liberty and the government's role to promote civil order, and this is a question I've asked a few different people, but how do we navigate or how do governments supposed to navigate religious liberty when perhaps the expressions of other religions either go directly against the Constitution, let's say like the caste system in Hinduism or something like that, or Sharia law or something like that, or even more generally, like, does religious liberty mean that we have to be okay with like New York City shining lights green for in the celebration of Islam? Is that like, does that mean something that I have to be fine with or governments have to approve? Or because one of the things that kind of gets fuzzy for me too is the ontology of a state compared to the ontology of the individuals who are working in that state. So like, you know, is it, would it be okay to give tax breaks to Christian churches, but not to mosque or something like that? Like, is that violate religious liberty? I mean, I think it probably does in the way that our constitution and the courts probably think it does, but I'm just curious just in principle, like what, like help us think, navigate some of these thorny issues if you have the time or.
Yeah, no, I mean, these are fascinating conversations and the reason I think they're so fruitful is that it's a little bit like what you might characterize as capitalism or democracy more broadly, like it's the worst system except for all the others, right? That, and we haven't arrived at a kind of a equilibrium in terms of a solution as a society. And in fact, I think a deeply conservative with a small C way of thinking about things is you don't actually arrive at solutions. You just sort of figure out ways to continue to live together and to preserve the good that God has graced you with, you know, the task of preserving while you're here, and have that kind of stewardship responsibility. So, It's an evolving conversation. It certainly has been for 2.5 centuries in the United States, and it's going to be, Lord willing, for the next 2.5 centuries. And you have to, I mean, that's sort of the disposition I come at these questions from, certainly as a theologian and academic and not a practicing attorney or a constitutional lawyer or anything like that. So I should add that caveat in there. I'd be happy to get you one of our First Liberty attorneys if you want to really dig into some of the case law and the precedents and things like that. But just at that more kind of conceptual level, I think there are a lot of different solutions that have been proposed both historically as well as like in contemporary settings, right? We can look at different models across the world and see all kinds of things that are being tried. And that, I think, will actually lead you to look at what the United States has been able to do for the last 2.5 centuries and come to a greater appreciation of the uniqueness of it, right? I mean, there are places where there's more or less establishment, of a particular institutional form of religion or a denomination, a church, a confessional system, then that may be more or less robust in terms of the space that it gives to other things, other belief systems or other worldviews. So it may tolerate other things, but it privileges one over the other. I don't understand the American system be doing anything like that. I think the American system, on some accounts, and I think it's certainly plausible, is a Protestant kind of conviction and animating spirit behind it without embedding those confessional particularities into the constitutive documents themselves and the text themselves. So it's a little bit like a version of liberalism, if you want to call it that, from Christian convictions, but not requiring more confessional or specific allegiances in order for us to find ways to live together. I don't know if I'm articulating that very well, but it's a little bit like the conclusion doesn't require, the conclusion comes out of authentic, Reformed or Protestant or even more broadly Christian principles, but it's a conclusion that is open for those who can affirm those propositions or affirm that kind of a structure from other perspectives as well, right? And I think that's kind of the best you can hope for in a fallen world, right? We're not ever gonna all agree on all kinds of things, including some of the deepest questions about our relationship to God and what's true about reality and what those truths require of me in response. The best we can do, I think, is a kind of a modus vivendi, a find a way to live together in symbiosis, in harmony, and aim at the kind of flourishing that God allows for to be possible this side of the eschaton. So that's a little bit like, yeah, I know that's kind of vague, but those are the big broad strokes of the way that I tend to think about these issues is not trying to find, over specify in policy the truth in that way while being responsible for what you're convicted is true, and that you can't be agnostic about reality and some of these deep questions, and that there's no such thing as strict objectivity or neutrality with a lot of these questions. And in fact, one of the great, I think, conceits of the 20th century is that there is some kind of an objective neutral state out there that is value free, when in fact, of course, it's smuggling in all kinds of values. And so some of the critiques of, liberalism by post-liberalists, I have that kind of, I think, insight in them. It doesn't require their conclusions, by the way, I don't think. But maybe I'm rambling a little bit. You got me kind of going here, but it's a good question. Thank you. Yeah.
Have you heard about the official sponsor of the London Lyceum and Hanover Press? It's Professor Lending, your premier home financing guide, helping you not only purchase a home, but steward it well for you, your family, and your future. Founded by me, Jordan Stefaniak, and staffed by local church leaders, we exist to bring clarity and trust back into the lending process. Home financing can feel confusing, oftentimes sketchy, and that's why we're here, to offer integrity, transparency, education, and excellent service. Too often there is zero education in the mortgage process and you're left completely hanging, and that's not right. That's why you should check us out at professorlending.com. That is professorlending.com. Whether you're a first-time buyer, working with a unique property like a farm, or a builder needing liquidity, or even an investor looking to expand your portfolio, we have solutions tailored for you. So check us out, Professor Lending, financing with integrity for families who care about their future.
Oh, this has been very helpful. So you mentioned just in the early American documents, a sort of, for lack of a better word, like Protestant ethic, spirit, culture without requiring confessional commitments. I think a lot of thinkers are recognizing the sort of lack of shared bonds we have as a nation right now. and some just various and sharp, sometimes sharply divided views of life and culture. And so do you think that that early sort of normative sort of culture is recoverable at this point? And what sort of place Christianity has there? And
yeah,
what maybe some hurdles or first steps are towards that?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to the question is, I don't think, you know, the situation sociologically, politically, theologically in 1776 is recoverable, nor is that some kind of ideal in the sense that, you know, everything's got to be a decline afterwards, that that's what we've got to get back to. I think it presents a kind of a model for how we might find ways to live together amidst plurality. And the pluralism that you had there was perhaps nothing like as expansive as what we have today. So the specifics might be different in terms of many more different kinds of worldviews. And I would just add many more kinds of, like, numbers of people, right? Like, I think there's a scale issue here when we're talking about the number of people that are now in the United States and how many can plausibly fit together, you know, in a polity, in a functional polity. We're straining in many ways at the kinds of institutional structures that were conceived of in the 18th century. We have a much more space that we're dealing with now than they were dealing with then in the, you know, the original environment of the construction of the Constitution and so on. So all of that's all, those are just kind of offhand variables that I think things are so different now in the 21st century, including technologically and so on, that I just think it's a kind of nostalgic appeal that all of us can understand at some level, but I don't think has any real cachet in terms of providing a positive vision going forward. So I do believe that there is a kind of a, I don't know what you want to call it, a functional ecumenism, maybe, common ground, you know, that can be found and ought to be pursued from people, by people from many different worldviews. So I'll give you an analogy. And again, this is closer in some sense temporally, but still very distant from us. But one of the figures I do a lot of work on is Abraham Kuyper, Dutch Reformed figure working at the end of the 19th, early 20th century in the Netherlands. Well, the Netherlands at that point, you know, is facing all kinds of social challenges and economic challenges and political challenges. And one of the challenges is pluralism. Now, again, the pluralism that they're facing in the Netherlands is nothing like the kinds of pluralism we're facing in terms of challenges and opportunities in the United States now. But for them, at that time, it's, you know, the Dutch Reformed, it's Roman Catholics, it's what Kuyper would often refer to as liberals, which we could unpack that term, Jews, certainly, and socialists and all other kinds of people, right? So maybe five or six different identifiable worldviews that are kind of the main players in the public square at his time. And Kuyper is trying to find a way from his deeply Calvinistic convictions to articulate a way for all of these groups to live together on their own terms and out of their own convictions, right? And I see that as a kind of a model for what we're doing now. Yes, again, the pluralism that we face in terms of the numbers and types of people and their worldviews is much more diverse and larger than it was certainly even the 19th as opposed to like the 18th century in America. But the kinds of impulses and models, I think, are there for us to learn from. All of that's a kind of presage of the, I won't take nearly as long here. But what Kuyper did was look for the common ground, right? And say, yes, I disagree with Catholics on justification and the authority of the Pope. Because I'm a theologian, I'm going to engage in really robust polemics against a lot of what Roman Catholics believe. But then when I'm talking about, you know, running for public office, or I'm looking at things that we have to figure out in terms of policy, there's a lot of common ground. And in fact, we have a lot to learn from them, he says in one of his speeches. The Roman Catholics are far ahead of us in their consideration of the social question, for example, he says. And he explicitly endorses Leo XIII's 1891 encyclical Rerum Novarum and says, all he's saying here are common Christian principles and teachings that are applicable to every confession, basically, of Christianity, and we can all learn from it. So that's the kind of approach that I think we can model. It's certainly, there are limits, right? But that we can model with people we might otherwise think are only going to be our social enemies or antagonistic towards. My closest analogy to what Kuiper was trying to do in an American setting would be something like a natural law ecumenism or something like that. Politics of the Tao, it's been called. I certainly care whether you believe in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, but in terms of politics, it's not necessary for you to share my confessional convictions for us to agree on some specific policies with respect to reality and the moral order. And in that sense, it's not so important to me how you reason to the conclusions, but it's more about whether you are aligned in terms of those issues and your moral convictions with the moral order, the natural law, or the Tao, as Lewis called it. So I think maybe that's one way of thinking about this, is that you could have a kind of politics of the Tao or politics of the natural law, broadly understood in terms of responding to the realities that are out there that God has embedded in creation and in his preserving orders.
You know, natural law is one of those kind of buzzwords right now as well. It's definitely one of those areas where I think Catholics have kind of outpaced Protestants in, and I think Protestants are kind of catching up a little bit. The cynic in me sees a lot of political engagement being kind of, for many people on the left and right, me just boiling down to tweeting the right things at the right time, you know, virtue signaling to others. That's clearly not what y'all are doing. So I guess, how does the natural law function in the specific actions that y'all do as a center? And then if you want to get into kind of the meta theory stuff, I know this is maybe a bigger question, like, where does the center fall in terms of the new natural law debate? Do they find more selves like identifying with someone like Finnis and Robert George and those guys, are more like classical natural law, or is even that framing of it not fair to the new natural law people? Because I know they didn't come up with that term themselves. And so if you want to get to that debate, you can. If not, we can talk about it at a different time. So,
sure. I mean, I can talk a little bit about it, I think, in a way that's going to be helpful for our conversation. I think of us at the CRCD as kind of a big tent approach to these things, right? So certainly, I have my own convictions and tradition and scholarship that I bring to bear, and that's deeply informed by a natural law perspective, broadly speaking. To paraphrase Kuiper, I just invoked him with respect to Leo. The Catholics are very far ahead of us on the social question. You could say the same thing about natural law. The Catholics are very far ahead of us, speaking as Protestants, on natural law. But it didn't have to be that way. I mean, some of the work I've done is on the retrieval of natural law as an authentically, broadly Protestant, inclusive of Reformed and Lutheran approaches in the 16th and 17th centuries and so on. So it's not the case that it's only a Roman Catholic kind of a thing, although it has been dominated certainly by Roman Catholic voices and the Roman Catholic tradition, and justly so. I mean, there's a lot there. It's a very robust tradition, which includes the kinds of diversity that you were just referring to, whatever you want to use it, a classical versus new natural law approaches and so on. So yes, the CRCD is committed to, broadly speaking, a kind of natural law approach, which I think is there in the American founding, again, broadly understood. I don't see a huge necessary distinction between natural rights and natural law kinds of understandings. There's a way of synthesizing those terminologies in the way those are grounded in a moral objectivist kind of view, broadly speaking. So in that sense, we take a Big Ten approach. We definitely have scholars who are more or less steeped in a particular approach, who have studied with, you know, with Robbie George and others, who would identify us with the new natural law school, as others have termed it, and so on. One of the things we do in our programs is run faculty seminars where we get together and have read, you know, 200 or 300 pages of text together, and then over the course of a weekend, talk about those texts. And one of the ones that we just did was on the jurisprudence of Robert George. So I wouldn't classify myself as a new natural lawyer, partly because I'm not sophisticated enough to know what that really would entail. I myself am learning, but certainly we've had, you know, seminars, scholars contribute to our things, affiliated with us, who would, you know, identify as new natural law people or with the Finnis Grisez, Robbie George school of things, and others who wouldn't, and say, you know, read that that distinction much differently. So broadly, yes, inclusive of natural law in the sense that there's an objective moral order and we have to align ourselves with it and as God's will. But a little bit more of a Big Ten or agnostic in terms of the schools or the details of what that has to entail.
So you just mentioned a faculty seminar and just reading groups that you guys are doing. If some of our listeners wanted to kind of benefit and engage with the work done by the center, what are some of the main things you guys do and what would some steps be to take for them?
Yeah, so I mentioned before that First Liberty had been doing some student programs. One of the things they wanted to do with the center was bring those together in a more coherent, consistent fashion and expand them too. So we run a number of programs that are aimed directly at students, some undergrads as well as those who are discerning grad school. So we have kind of long weekend type programs during the academic year for undergraduates who are considering various things. We just finished one earlier this year in DC that's focused on people who are either thinking about going to law school or going into public service or working in government. We'll have another one in April called the Savannah Seminar that's focused more broadly on humanities and this kind of classical understanding of the American Republic and the relationship between personal morality and virtue and civic virtue and civic responsibility. And then we have a summer fellowship that's focused for 10 weeks in residence called the Shaftesbury Fellowship for people who are thinking about going further in grad school. And that's really an attempt to like give people a sense of what it's like. You're going to be in academic seminars every week. You're going to have your own research project that you're working on with a faculty mentor and have to present your research at the end of that summer. So those are some of our student programs. We also have some publications that are more or less accessible. We have an academic journal that we run called the Journal of Religion, Culture, and Democracy. We run some of those faculty seminars that I've just mentioned. And we also have a weekly, for lack of a better term, a newsletter. It's a little bit like a magazine in the sense that I didn't want us to be like every other place and just be like, here's what we did last week or here's what we did this month. So we have a little bit of that in there, like here are the publications you may be interested in or here are the events that are coming up. But our main kind of weekly touch point is called the Reading Wheel Review. So one of the things we're interested in at the CRCD is conserving and preserving civilization, broadly speaking. And we think books are really important for that and literacy is really important for that. And so we came up with this idea to basically spend a month on a book and engage with that book over the course of a month and do that in different ways. So the first week would be typically an excerpt from the book. And then the next week might be a review. And then we might have somebody write an essay that's kind of on the topic and engages with the book or the kinds of arguments or the topics that are covered in the book in a more expansive way. And then usually an interview with the author or someone who is an expert in the field. And that's our main kind of newsletter, for lack of a better term, as I said, too. And that's available on Substack as well and a podcast. So the website is crcd.net. That's where all of this kind of stuff and other things that I haven't mentioned yet are probably covered. We do our own original academic and policy research, too. One of our big projects is on state protections for free exercise in the 50 states. So not at the federal level, but the differences in protections for religious liberty across all 50 states called Religious Liberty in the States. That's an example of the kind of policy work that we're doing too.
Well, thank you, Jordan. That's super fascinating. This whole conversation has been just exciting. These are the type of things I can talk about for a long time and just have, just kind of go around the horn and just different issues come up and ask questions about it. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of the London Lyceum podcast. I hope it got you thinking.